When it came to Apollo 11, there was great public excitement about the mission. Did that really translate into the station, or were people just really too focused on their job?
I don't remember any great concerns on mine or anybody else's part, that we recognised that NASA had done all it could to build up competence in all parties to be able to run a successful moon landing. Again, that might have been naive. We were all young, of course. We're all in sort of late 20s, early 30s, and I guess I'd be far more conservative if I was doing the job today. But at the time, I was comfortable that that, you know, in all likelihood, the mission should be a success. I was confident in our competence to support it. The build up from 7, 8, 9, and 10 was perfect. I do remember that we had an enormous amount of media interest, and it was getting a little bit disruptive. It had done the previous missions, but especially so on Apollo 11. So I suggested to Tom Reed that we have a media day whereby we invited anybody and everybody who had a media hat on, radio, television, and press, to come out on the one day, have all the staff on board, all sitting at their consoles, and they would push and pull every switch and button and put up Lissajous figures and wear the antenna around the sky and play with tapes and others, do everything that the media wanted for one day. And then say, well, thank you very much, now off you go. And that worked out much better than even I'd anticipated. Everybody was happy. The media were happy. The troops were happy. Being able to spin magnetic tapes around and be proud in their roles. So that aspect of it, hit us. And we had various VIPs coming through and lots of press releases, and we did have a PR man come out from NASA. Can't remember his name now, but he set up with a little corner of the building to be able to take Polaroid pictures of the TV and the like. So Apollo 11 was launched in the same manner, and everything went according to plan. The actual landing, we weren't tracking for that. It was about 6 a.m. Australian time when that happened. And I didn't actually hear it. I was asleep. I'd been on a long day shift tracking the day before. As I recollect, the moon was quite a southerly declination through that era, and we had quite long passes. You know, they could be as long as sort of 12 to 14-hour passes. So with the pre-configuration and the post-thing, they were quite long shifts. And it took the best part of 45 minutes, maybe more, to get to and from Honeysuckle. So the day was long, and I was asleep when they landed on the moon. But I came out to... There were two of us, two deputy station directors at the time, myself and Ian Grant. Ian was handling the out-of-real-time operations activities, configuring the station. Before every pass, we'd spend 2 to 3 to 4 hours checking out every piece of equipment, calibrating it. And that was a major and highly important task. And Ian used to sort of run the station during those periods. One other role I had in Apollo 11 was to coordinate the parks contribution. I'd been to and from parks 2 or 3 times. I remember that there was tens of k's of gravel road in that era. So I got to know John Bolton quite well and Dave Cook at parks before Apollo 11. And the fellow who came out from Goddard Space Flight Center, Bob Taylor, I knew him quite well. I'd met with him at Goddard over the years. He was the Goddard Space Flight Center USB system engineer. And so we had overlapped a few times, and so I knew him. And I had influence over the configuration of parks and the implementation of microwave links between parks and Honeysuckle. Because keep in mind that the priority of the support from parks was not television. It was to be able to ensure that the telemetry from the astronauts and their backpacks and the lunar module got to Houston with the maximum reliability. And so dual microwave links were implemented from Parkes into Sydney, and then Sydney out to Honeysuckle, where the data was processed. And then there was yet more microwave links from Honeysuckle to Sydney for us to be able to send out the television signal from Honeysuckle. So that was another of my responsibilities. And on the day of the first step, I was running the operations up to the point where we started to get the first television signal, at which time Tom Reed sat in the what we call the Ops 1 seat, and I coordinated the Parkes connection and followed when they were acquiring and when they got a good signal and when they were on the main beam, and told Tom when that had occurred. And on the recording, you can hear Tom then go and get Kevin Gallegos to select the Parkes data at Honeysuckle.
Honeysuckle had, three signals coming in, Honeysuckle's dish, Tid Mbilla's dish from the wing, and Parkes as well.
Yes, that's correct. Through all of this, the Tid Mbilla antenna and its USB equipment, that's transmitters and receivers, were configured tracking the command module. It was orbiting the moon, of course, while the lunar module was on the surface. And the beam width of the antenna was such that you couldn't quite get both signals in the one dish. The moon subtends about half a degree, roughly, at the Earth, and the beam width of the 85-foot dishes at Tid Mbilla and Honeysuckle is about a third of a degree. And so, although you could get a usable signal, it was far better to point an antenna at the orbiting command module. So that was Tid Mbilla's role. And that data, of course, was as important as any other data. And I might also say, probably more important than the television from the lunar module, because Collins was on his own in that spacecraft and could have conceivably needed every possible help in coping with anything that happened on board the command module. These are sort of mundane, pragmatic, practical considerations which sort of didn't even make the news then, and let alone make the news now. But as an operations person, the art is keeping your priorities always in front of you and not allowing yourself to be distracted onto bells and whistles and peripherals, of which I've always felt television was so. But understandably, the television ended up being the most dramatic and most appreciated and most comprehended signal of the lot.
And unexpectedly, Honeysuckle ended up being the source for the worldwide TV of the first step for those first few minutes.
That's correct. And most people know how that came to pass, that there was a transmitter fire at Tid Mbilla, which meant that the role of Tid Mbilla and Honeysuckle was reversed on the actual lunar day, whereby Tid Mbilla was on the CSM and Honeysuckle on the LEM. And the moon had not quite risen above the 30-degree elevation limit at Parkes, and so the signal through Honeysuckle was the one that was used. And, of course, Goldstone, the California station, was receiving the signal at the same time, but there were some problems there, and the Honeysuckle signal was better and was preferred. I might say at the time, I did vaguely remember hearing something in the background saying we're selecting the Honeysuckle signal, but at the time, that was certainly not my concern, and it was only at the end of the day that I think it was Bernie Scrivener, our PR person, said, "You do realize that they use the Honeysuckle signal to go to the world?" I said, "Well, tell you the truth, no, I didn't really realize that, nor was it of any concern whether they were or weren't at the time." And so there's that distinction between the real-time operational environment on the one hand and the big picture on the other that we all still analyze 40 years on.
Just to come back to the transmitter fire at Tid Mbilla, if that had not happened, then the Tid Mbilla dish would have been used, DSS-42, for the lunar module, but the data and the television would have still come to Honeysuckle for processing before sending off.
That's correct. Yeah. The microwave link between Tid Mbilla and Honeysuckle meant that the spectrum of the received signal at Tid Mbilla was shipped over as a spectrum to Honeysuckle, and then the various bits of it were extracted, of which TV was one, and telemetry was another, and voice and biomedical information. All those things were extracted and massaged, manipulated, filtered, and shipped out. But again, you see, we never used to sort of look on Tibbin Buller as anything other than really a part of Honeysuckle. It was just part of the complex. There was no sort of rivalry, as far as I can recollect, especially with me, who'd spent 18 months there anyway and knew everybody personally at Tibbin Buller through this era. So they were and were made to feel part of the whole picture. I might say that that wasn't necessarily the case in the US, that JPL were a little bit jealous of their Deep Space Network, and Goddard were jealous of their then Manned Spaceflight Network, and that we and I in particular could provide a bridging between those organizations, which I occasionally did.
So the Tibbin Buller antenna was, in effect, a second antenna for Honeysuckle. It just happened to be, what, 25 kilometers away?
Yeah. That's quite an accurate way of putting it. The staff at Tibbin Buller happened to be from the staff who supported the deep space missions as well as the manned space flight. They had experience on both sides of the fence. Things were a little different at Goldstone, as I understand it. The staff at the wing site there came from the prime site. And in the early days, Goddard or JPL wanted just one single door to access the wing from the prime, and there was a big key. There were two keys, in fact, that had to be operated, one in the deep space side and one in the manned space flight side, that had to be operated together, and that switched the signal from the dish into either the deep space network equipment or the manned space flight network equipment. So there was a fair bit of politics went off between JPL and Goddard, and didn't enhance or simplify the work at the station at all, made it a little bit more complicated. When the TV first came on, I had no idea what I was seeing. I had no idea what to expect. There was a big white bit and a big black bit, as I recollect, and I didn't know what it meant, although after I don't know, 10 or 20 seconds, I suppose, we all sort of gathered it was there. The picture was always the right way up, as far as I recollect, at Tibbin Buller, whereas at Goldstone, initially it was upside down, and we have a recording where Goldstone is asked to operate the big magic switch to put the camera the right way up. Of course, it isn't exactly upside down, just by the way. The camera's at an angle even then, and so the angle that you traditionally see as it comes down the ladder is not accurate. It's out by, 15 degrees or something like that? I've always been a bit surprised that NASA, Goddard, Houston, or whoever's external Australia manipulates this video data has not got around to correcting it for that angle of the camera. That's apart from the gross one of the upside down.
And that was because the camera couldn't be mounted quite flat because of its handle, wasn't
it? Yeah, I don't know the full story, but the only place they appeared to be able to mount it, pointing it at the ladder, was a non-vertical surface, or non-horizontal surface, whichever way you want to consider it. And I think that was partly due to the relatively late idea of having the camera view the ladder as he came down it. I have an idea that the initial plans didn't really allow for that. They had a camera, but it was intended that either when the astronaut had got out, taken the camera off the lunar module and put it on a stand, then it would be turned on. And so the mounting of the TV camera was not optimum. It was good enough, but not perfect.
And the picture from Honeysuckle Creek, even though it was a smaller antenna compared with Parkes, it still was quite a good picture.
It was tolerable, considering all the equipment in series and all the analog manipulation and the fact that the signal as it came down was a different TV standard to the one that eventually had to be displayed in Australia or in in America. It was tolerable, and I've always felt that some of the mystique of that first walk flows from the graininess and poor quality but of that picture. If it had been crystal clear and coloured, perhaps it wouldn't have been, thought about as much, really. Also, it must have gone through many conversions in finding its way to other countries around the world, so God knows what it looked like in some of the more remote parts of the world.
It was a fairly low contrast, wasn't it, in the deep shadow of the limb?
Yes, and I think part of the problem was just coping with that enormous dynamic range of brightness and darkness that no one had to cope with before. Of course, as the missions went on, things improved, cameras improved, went from black and white to colour, but considering it was the first step on the moon for the first time with the first TV, I'm always of this view, I tend to be of the view that says I'm amazed when everything like that works, whereas
yes.
Others tend to say, why was it so poor?
Brian Sullivan talks about during the television turning around and seeing a great row of people behind him who'd snuck in to watch the TV and were just standing there motionless. Could you see that from where you were, or was that they were a little bit further down the building?
I can't remember. We only had a limited number of monitors. We only had two or three monitors in the station. We had one in the ops area, one in the video area, and we didn't have one up the front end. As I said at the time, my worries were the intermittent biomedical data, which we'd had, and ensuring that Parkes was properly configured and that we were receiving the signal from Parkes. As to what was actually happening in the station external to the operations area, I must say, I didn't have the time, nor did I have the feeling that I had to, worry or think about that.
The weather forecast for the day had snow down to 4,000 feet, honeysuckles of 3,700. Do you remember anything about the weather, or were you just too focused on what else was happening?
Not in any great detail, I must be honest. We didn't have any snow, as I recollect. There were times when we did have snow, I might say. I remember tramming through several inches of snow at Honeysuckle a couple of times. But no, on that day, it was just fairly cold and windy. There was no weather sufficient to compromise the tracking capabilities it seems there was at Parkes. The Parkes antenna had a lower wind rating for the antenna. But although I was worried about Parkes, as and when we were receiving perfectly good signals at Honeysuckle, I must say my worries about Parkes were insignificant. In other words, if Parkes had not been there, we would have still been able to supply the telemetry sufficiently well to Houston. And so, although obviously it was great to have, it was typically part of the manned spaceflight program, where you built in as much redundancy, as the Americans call it, as you could. So from that point of view, yes, Parkes was desirable, important, but not vital.
So during the moonwalk, as far as communications with the LEM, Goldstone was prime, but the handover to Honeysuckle took place just after the moonwalk, and on the recordings you can hear how much clearer the astronaut voice is, because it's coming directly from the moon rather than the moonwalk.
I've never sort of listened to that, and we haven't had the same debate about where the voice was taken from through any or all of this. I don't think anybody knows where the voice was being taken from. In general, Houston tended to take the voice from the station that was two-way, and it was the station that was transmitting. But there was no special technical or operational logic behind that. Any station that was receiving the downlink, and I might say including stations like Guam and Hawaii, would have all had usable voice. But just to keep things neat and tidy, I think Houston would have gone with Goldstone during the first TV, and then when the handover of the lunar module uplink was moved to Honeysuckle, I'm sure they took Honeysuckle then. But as I say, there was no technical reason why it had to be done that way. And similarly with the command module. Handing over the command module was a little more straightforward than the lunar module, in that with having loss of signal LOS every lunar orbit, it simply meant that at the end of one moon orbit, when Goldstorm finished, we were the two-way uplink station, the start of the next lunar orbit. And that is documented pretty well as to when we took over.
But to actually do a handover on the LEM, we had all sorts of things with the Doppler shift and so on.
Well, yes, but the manned flight communication system in some ways was simpler than the deep space. In the deep space handover system, you had to try and get the frequency of the outgoing station and the frequency of the incoming station as seen at the lunar module at the same frequency. So that meant tuning the transmitter to a particular frequency, correcting for Doppler and Earth's rotation of the ingoing and the incoming and the outgoing. But in the manned flight world, they had such enormous communication margins, they used a fairly brute force approach, whereby the frequency that we were transmitting was swept in a sort of a sawtooth manner around the optimum, and the phase lock loop on board the lunar module acquired the incoming signal, and then the outgoing station turned its transmitter off after about a 1 or 2 second overlap, and the receiver operator at the station could tell they'd acquired the uplink by watching the receive signal sweeping back and forth, and that was a confirmation when there were so-called two-way. So handovers were generally fairly straightforward. The only time that ever got complicated on the handover was as and when the lunar module was transmitting TV on FM, at which time you didn't have the phase lock loop configured on board the spacecraft, so although you're sweeping the uplink, it wasn't causing the downlink to sweep. And that confused people. Everybody knew it was going to happen, but it was not the normal way of having to cope with the handover.
Do you remember anything about the drive home on the day? What was it like after?
Not really. I think we were all a bit tired by that stage. I don't think exhilaration came into it, to tell you the truth. I think it was satisfaction at a job well done, or a job that had worked out. It was a sort of a culmination of a lot of time, a lot of energy. Each and every one was just a cog in the wheel, a vital cog, but nevertheless a cog. The machine required everybody, to be performing together and to know what they were doing, why they were doing it, and to be trained to cope with anything out in the ordinary. But no, generally the ride home was, you know, if you've got to such a stage whereby the car found its own way home, got to know the route pretty well. Initially, I used to try and sleep at the station. I didn't on Apollo 11, but after a while, I found it far better to drive home, and that 35, 40-minute drive, you could unwind, and then you'd somehow be sleeping when you got home. When the ESEP, so not only did we cope with the lunar module and the command module, we also had to be aware of the signal that came from the ESEP. Now, we weren't primed for that. This is where the Carnarvon station had a role, and Guam, I suppose, that rather than add an extra load to the main Apollo stations, the responsibility for the lunar packages was with the 9-meter stations, who had ample comm margin. But we certainly watched that signal as it came on, and that seismometer, as I understand it, worked for quite a while. That ESET package, as opposed to the ALSET package, only had a solar array for its power. Later ones had a radioisotope thermal generator power source, and that allowed them to operate for years, as I understand it. A vital part of this, on the Australian scene, of course, was the ground communications. All the resources and efforts that went into by PNG and OTC, and our own comms people who were here in Canberra at the Deakin Telephone Exchange, they had dozens of voice and data lines and teletype lines to keep configured and restore if there was any problems. I might say this was the era when they were starting to duplicate the Hume Highway between Canberra and Sydney, and there was hardly a week went by that the cable wasn't dug up somewhere along the way during the road construction. They learnt their lesson a bit there, by the way, as and when they did put in the fibre optic between Cam and Sydney, they intentionally ploughed it about 100 yards, not less than 100 metres away from the main highway, so the chance of it being dug up during any future road works was reduced.
So Australian commitment to Apollo, and Apollo 11 in particular, was really pretty major.
It was crucial. Unless honeysuckle was green, the missions wouldn't be launched. Although it is worth just keeping in mind that the spacecraft were designed to be as self-contained as possible. And so the astronauts had a lot of onboard navigation and a lot of onboard capability that wasn't utterly dependent on the ground communications. But nevertheless, for three people to cope with the technology of the era would have been quite very demanding and only really looked on as a contingency thing. Of course, when some of the crucial things that happened, like the burn to go into lunar orbit and the burn to come out of lunar orbit, all occurred without a view of the ground stations. So yes, Honeysuckle was crucial, and everybody's role was crucial, but there were always plenty of backups and alternatives and redundancies. However, one had to be skilled to recognize when a fault had occurred and to recognize what the options were to restore the service. And that is not as obvious and straightforward as you might think. We had backup communication circuits to get into Canberra that went over the microwave link to Tidbinbilla and then into Canberra. But the first time we exercised that, chaos reigned. Because first of all, you've got to get everybody to agree that the fault has occurred, and then you've got to get agreement by all the parties along the way as to what they'll do about it. And I sort of intentionally pulled that fault on a simulation to sort of highlight to all concerned that they weren't really prepared for what to do. And that made everybody sit down and think through how they would diagnose that a fault had occurred, who was responsible for fixing it, and who'd do what.
This interview with Mike Dinn was recorded by Colin McKellar for honeysucklecreek.net in July 2009.